All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And look, as promised, on this weekend show, we're getting two differing opinions on the economy, the markets, and interest rate policy, not just in the U.S., but around the world. You all heard from Jesse Felder in the first segment. Now it's time to switch our focus over with Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Financial Group, and also editor of the Book Report on Substack. I will post a link to that report in the show notes. I highly recommend signing up for the Book Report if you want to keep up to date, really on a daily basis, with key economic data, key market news, key earnings recaps. Peter really covers it all as that news comes out and is released throughout the day. It's a lot of information, but it is my go-to source every morning to get caught up on what some of the economic data has been and where the markets are moving. So, Peter, let's get right into it then. Let's hear your assessment of the overall health of the U.S. economy. The data seems to be hanging in fairly well, but you can point to certain areas that have been in contraction. The economy isn't growing as strong as it was, let's say, a year ago, but it's also not in negative territory. So, Peter, your overall assessment of the U.S. economy right now, please.
Well, I think it's important to break it out rather than giving one overall opinion. I've been referring to the overall opinion as being mixed and uneven, the economy, rather than saying it's good or it's bad or it's not, it's in the middle. You have pockets of strength, you have pockets of weakness. Pockets of strength are related to an enormous amount of government spending and the beneficiaries of that spend, whether you're in the healthcare business or you're receiving, you know, higher interest income relative to pre-2022 levels, or you're building a semiconductor plant in Arizona, or you're building an EV battery plant in Kansas. Those that are benefiting from that government spend, that's the area of the economy that's doing pretty well. If you are involved anything to do with AI and a beneficiary of the enormous amount of capital spending in that area, you're doing well. But if, on the other hand, if you are not, if you're in other parts of technology, like selling smartphones or PCs, your business is more challenged. If you are a lower to middle income consumer, the spending outlook is much more cautious. People are much more value seeking. They're being much more discriminating with how they spend their money. If you're in manufacturing, there's a recession going on, and it's been going on for about 2 years. If you're in the housing sector, if you're a real estate agent selling existing homes, business is probably pretty tough because there's not that much inventory and there are affordability issues that many people are facing. If you are in the new build market working for a bigger home builder, well, then business is probably okay building out communities because the market needs more product. So it's very bifurcated, a lot of mixed signals that I think sort of clouds anybody looking at what headline GDP tells you.
Yeah, Peter, it really takes a nuanced view because there are the pockets of strength, pockets of weakness, as you outlined. Maybe want to dig into a couple of those that you mentioned. I guess first off is the manufacturing having been in what some would dub recessionary territory the last couple of years. It kind of speaks to a larger theme that we don't necessarily have to have a recession that wipes out everything. It could actually be pockets of recession and pockets of growth. So maybe just speak to the manufacturing sector and how that differs than some of the other sectors like an AI sector.
Well, manufacturing is a couple of things, and it's not just in the U.S., it's globally. And we all know that people spent a lot of money on stuff in COVID and coming out of COVID and then shifted their spend to other things. So there's basically a hangover from that. I mean, if you put in a deck in 2020 and 2021, well, you're not going to put in a deck soon after in 2024. You're going to wait a long time, if at all, to do it again. So I think there's that hangover effect, and that's one of the main reasons. Also, I think it was going into 2022, there were a lot of retailers that were worried about the supply chains, and they all stocked up on too much inventory in 2022, and going into 2023, we're left with too much stuff. And I think that, at least on the retail side, particularly the bigger ones, have been much more diligent and disciplined in trying to keep some lean inventories. And then, of course, you have higher interest rates. And for some stuff, whether it's high cost items like a home or a car or even, you know, an expensive TV that you get at Best Buy, chances are for some people, or many people, you're going to be financing it. Financing costs have obviously gone up a lot, and that's also crimping the demand for manufactured goods. So I think that's all combining for the recession we're seeing in that particular area of the global economy.
Peter, what's your assessment on inflation? We keep on hearing that inflation is going to remain sticky above that 2% level. Some people are even saying that inflation runs higher to 3%, 4%, maybe even back to 5%. Where do you see inflation playing out, and what do you see the major drivers being?
Well, on the good side, which is where we've seen the most amount of disinflation, we'll have to see. I think, you know, there's possibility that we start to bottom out. And I say that for a couple of reasons. Number one, if China is successful in just at least stabilizing their economy, I don't think they're looking to necessarily stimulate their economy. They're looking to stabilize, particularly their housing market. That's their biggest priority. So maybe that's one factor. At some point, maybe this manufacturing recession ends and you start to get some inventory rebuild that could, you know, draw a line under the goods deflation we've seen. So that's just one thing I'm watching. On the services side, rental increases will continue to slow. So we'll still get, I think we'll get, you know, deflationary pressures on the service side in the early part into the middle part of next year. But I think we're sowing the seeds for reacceleration in rents that will show up in services inflation at some point in 2026. I think my real belief with inflation is we're not just magically going back to 1-2% and staying there. I think we're in a new world of inflation volatility. And, you know, if you look at the tips market, at least over the next 5 years, tips are saying, okay, inflation is going to average a little more than 2%. I think that's overly generous. And I think that something around 3-ish or more is where inflation will eventually settle out at. Obviously, there's an election here in a couple of weeks. We'll see who wins and what sort of tariffs we're all going to get, which will be inflationary also, as it raises the taxes on a variety of different goods that companies will try their best to pass on to the rest of us, in addition to whether this government spending continues on this extraordinarily dangerous path, which is itself inflationary because it's just throwing money that we don't have onto the economy via borrowing, and that itself can potentially be inflationary as well.
Well, Peter, just to that point you just made, I think a lot of people, when they classically think about where inflation comes from, it's an increase in the money supply, and it's a lot of, I guess, out of control fiscal spending from the government side, but also the monetary policy of central banks. Is that more germane, or are these, I guess, goods and service issues, and then also, you know, possibly increases in energy, things like oil, if it has another tick up, are those more germane? Where is the inflation coming from if it is stickier and it stays around longer?
Well, you know, I mentioned China. I mentioned the possibility of at some point this manufacturing recession is going to end. I do have my eyes very closely on commodity prices to see whether how they respond to what China announced, in addition to how the geopolitics are playing out with the price of oil. So we'll have to see. I mean, historically, there is no goods inflation. Historically, because of technology and production efficiencies and so on, there isn't any goods inflation. It's usually on the services side that tends to drive non-transitory inflation. So, you know, a few things that I'm watching at it, but look at PPI in the U.S. PPI in the U.S. is still remaining around 2-ish%. It's not falling into disinflation. So we have to keep our eye on that. We've seen a very sharp rise in transportation costs. If you look at container shipping prices, they've been on a roller coaster, but they're still more than almost triple where we were where they started the year. If you look at the World Container Index, looking at the Shanghai to Rotterdam or Shanghai to LA or Shanghai to New York routes, the shipping costs, while they're off their summer highs, they're up a lot from the beginning of the year. And what's happened was, even with the strike, is there's been a lot of shifting of goods deliveries ahead of the holidays into air cargo. Air cargo prices have jumped a lot. So there are pockets of stickiness. And then on the services side, you still have higher labor costs, which not everyone can pass through via, you know, can absorb via productivity gains. A lot of times they can't. If you're a restaurant, if you own two restaurants, you don't have all these productivity levers to pull. And if wage costs are going up, chances are you're going to raise menu prices in order to recapture that. So I still think that there's some underlying bid to inflation. A lot of it is government spending induced. And if, you know, the Fed gets too cute here with cutting interest rates, then that can stoke even potentially more demand for goods where people are borrowing money, if they can borrow cheaper, then, you know, they're more inclined to make a purchase of a good. So these are the different things that I'm paying attention to. I'm still, you know, I'm not confident on where we settle up in inflation. I'm more confident that it's going to happen closer to 3 rather than 2.
Let's talk about interest rate cuts then, because that is the trend right now. The U.S. came out with a 50 basis point cut. Canada's been cutting. The ECB's been cutting. China's been the most aggressive out there. They're in full-on stimulus mode, even though they're not calling it that. How do these rate cuts, in your eyes, play through the system, economy-wise and market-wise?
Well, what's been most interesting is that even before the Fed cut, the market had already priced in more than 200 basis points of rate cuts right before the upside surprise in the September payroll number. The December 2025 Fed funds futures contract was yielding 2.9% from an effective rate before the rate cut of 5.33%. So we had priced in a lot. Now that December 2025 contract is closer to 330 instead of 290. But now that the Fed said, hey, let's cut 50 instead of 25, in addition to the China news, in addition to the good payroll number, in addition to the upside in the CPI that we just got, you know, rates have done nothing but go straight up. So the Fed actually shot themselves in the foot by cutting 50, because the market then immediately took away 50 basis points of cuts. You know, they're obviously still expecting a bunch of cuts through the end of next year, but they definitely took away some of them. And I think it was, you know, a sign that the Fed's going to have to tread very gingerly here. You know, I've been thinking, at least for now, that we're on the cusp of not a broad rate cutting cycle, but more of a rate tweaking cycle. And we heard from voting members Mary Daly, Raphael Bostic, Chris Waller, who also alluded to that whereas a few weeks ago the market was saying they'll cut another 25 in November, another 25 in December. Now there's a possibility maybe there's only one more 25 basis point cut by the end of the year. So I just think that, you know, markets are just too believing of that, okay, the economy softens, Fed has all this flexibility, this huge ability to just respond to anything that comes our way with rate cuts. And I just think it's going to be more complicated than that. I don't think they're going to have the same level of flexibility. I think that, you know, inflation and the data and the government spending is going to be okay enough that rates are going to stay sticky around these levels, I believe.
Well, Peter, when you look at the interest rates and the path of them, you know, the yield curve has uninverted now, and then it's steepened at the long end of the curve and normalized a bit. Do you think it's the inverse of the bond market action? So do you think that these markets are reacting, and bonds in general are reacting, to the Fed rate cutting cycle and trying to get in front of that, and that's why they moved ahead of the Fed? Or do you think that they're reacting to the strength of the bond auctions themselves? I know that you put out a lot of research on the strength of the various time-oriented treasuries and how those bond auctions are going. What trends are you seeing in that department?
The auctions, interestingly, have, you know, there was a long string of poor auctions, particularly as the Fed was raising interest rates, and they've gotten more selectively better. But I think the general trend, though, with auctions, with the treasury market generally, is foreigners, while they continue to buy, even though you have to sort of differentiate foreigners because Cayman Islands falls under foreigners, and, you know, those aren't, you know, natural, you know, those are more hedge funds, but they're buying less as a percentage of total issuance. The U.S. budget deficit is essentially being mostly financed by the U.S. private sector, whether it's individuals, whether it's pension funds, or insurance companies and so on, and less so foreigners. So that means that, you know, we don't have the same sort of help that we used to. And also the Fed, which is no longer financing it either, at least for now, via QT. So, you know, with the auctions, it's a good sentiment gauge on that particular day that it's issued, but the carry forward is more going to be responding to expectations for growth and inflation and what the Fed is going to do. But I do think that there's going to be an underlying sort of bid to the longer end yield as gold continues to trade higher and people do seem to be questioning U.S. debts and deficits now more so than ever, particularly with a 6% GDP or a budget deficit relative to GDP and a 4% unemployment environment, which is, I don't think has ever been seen before. So I think this is all combining for, like I said, a sort of a bid to underneath longer end bond yields.
What about the bid that we've seen in the markets too? A lot of the naysayers, the bears out there, were saying that there wasn't any breadth out there. It was being led by the Magnificent Seven, the AI movement. We've seen a pullback in a lot of the Magnificent Seven stocks and some of the AI stocks as well, but we've seen a broadening out. You look at the equal weight S&P, that recently was at all-time highs. What do you make of this market where, look, gold's doing well, markets are doing well. Where is this market in your eyes?
A couple things. So I think we started to get a change in complexion in early to mid-July when the market absorbed all the tech earnings, particularly the AI-related tech companies, Microsoft and Google and Amazon and so forth. And I think what started to happen was, because up to that point, if you just said the word AI, your stock rallied. If you spent a lot of money on AI, your stock rallied. If you got that spend, like NVIDIA, obviously your stock rallied because they directly reflected an increase in revenue. But after Q2 earnings, the market started to say, okay, well, we have the spenders on AI and they're spending gobs of money. And, you know, what's the payoff for that? And then on the other hand, who's getting that money? And I think the market sort of switched to who's getting that money. And we started to see some sort of differentiation and some questions being asked on all this AI spend and what are the benefits going to be and so forth. And I think since then, we've seen a nice broadening out of the market to other things outside of those names. So the S&P 493 finally got some love, as did mid caps and small caps, deservingly so, because a lot of them got cheap and a lot of them have so dramatically underperformed the big names that it was due for some mean reversion. Also, some foreign markets, and particularly China, just over the past month, also got finally some love as well. So I think that's, on one hand, that's a healthy thing. But on the other hand, you know, if you lose that big cap tech leadership, you have to ask yourself is who's going to, on a sustainable basis, pick up the baton.
Well, one area of focus in the markets that has gotten some of that love that was ignored before has kind of been the value sector, Peter. We've seen things like healthcare or REITs or utilities, and to that point, precious metals also get a bid. Is that just because everything's widening out and so all sectors are getting a bid, or is it because some of those are interest rate sensitive? Why the move into value stocks while growth tech stocks are also still rallying to some degree? It seems like it's an everything rally, or is there something else going on under the surface?
Well, it didn't start out as an everything rally. As I mentioned, there was a rotation or a shift out of those big cap tech stocks into other things. And the NASDAQ, at least through, you know, August, September, really underperformed. It's only recently with NVIDIA and Apple did they, and Meta's traded well. So those have played some catch up. But outside of that, with Google and Tesla, even Microsoft is well below its highs. But it was related to that shift, but also the Fed in market pricing and a lot of rate cuts, small, medium-sized businesses, they were most negatively impacted by the sharp rise in interest rates. And, you know, they're going to benefit if rates stay at least where they are, or the Fed continues to cut on the shorter end, depending on where in the curve you borrow. But a lot of these smaller companies borrow SOFR plus, and if SOFR falls because the Fed's cutting short-term interest rates, then they can benefit from that. So I think that also was a help to at least that part of the market and value stocks generally.
So Peter, is this a time in the market where investors can still be relatively aggressive, have a lot of money at work other than taking strictly, I guess, cash positions, putting their money in money market funds just to earn a yield?
Well, money markets obviously paying you a nice yield. You know, this stock market rally has really been, since the early part of the year, has really been driven by PE ratio expansion. You know, there's been very little change in earnings expectations. In fact, they're slightly down. So this is talking about going from a high teens multiple to a low 20s multiple. And, you know, 22 times earnings with, you know, 4% earnings growth expected for this quarter, with rates staying up and the Fed maybe not being able to cut interest rates as much as the market thought, I think, you know, anybody who focuses on valuation, and we know I say that because somewhat sarcastically, because we know there's, you know, people in the market that are very agnostic when it comes to inflation. You know, they're just focused on the story. That I still think, you know, you're trading at these valuations with the Fed not being so friendly, I don't think as the market is priced in, inflation remaining sticky, so and so on, labor markets being, you know, softening up, that I think people just have to be careful and just have eyes wide open. Right now they don't. You know, we have seemingly everyone all in. We have households that are all in, and everyone thinking that whatever comes our way, the Fed's going to be able to save us from that. I do think that there's a level of complacency out there that people should just be aware of.
Well, a lot of people we've asked about the valuations, Peter, over the last really year or two or last couple of years. And a lot of people said the valuations don't matter until they matter. So it seems like they are starting to matter more to investors, and they are starting to look at where things are priced versus their earnings. It brings up a good point about gold and the gold equities. We've mentioned several times in this call that gold has done well and it's had a banner year. It's outperformed the equities, to the U.S. equities to a great extent, up over 30%. But the gold equities themselves haven't fared that well, but they have the fattest margins they've ever had for the quarter we just saw. Will better earnings in gold equity producers finally get attention from the Wall Street crowd that maybe has been ignoring the sector but can't ignore that earnings growth forever?
So I think so. I hope so. I think that we have reached a point, and to your point about fat margins, I think this earnings season is going to be very interesting when it comes to that, and whether companies can fully benefit from that rise in price. If you look at Barrick Gold, who gave some, you know, just some production numbers, not their full earnings, you know, gold's up 0.5% and the stock is trading down. So it's, I think just people have gotten so burned by owning these things over the years that it's more of a show me the money type mentality. But hopefully this quarterly earnings season in the metals, they will finally show investors the money. And if that's the case, then I think that these stocks will finally get more re-rated relative to where the price of gold is, rather than distill this taint of sort of apathy and disgust towards them where they've disappointed investors for so long.
Barrick's a good example too, because look, they're going to be earning better margins on their production, but their production, I think, has been falling year over year. So when you look at maybe gold miners, do you think the market wants to see more growth just in terms of production outside of the underlying metals price moving higher?
Well, on one hand, yes, investors always love to see growth. On the other hand, if you're a sort of a generalist investor and you want to get exposure to the gold mining group, yeah, you'll buy an ETF or you'll buy the biggest names like Newmont, Barrick, or Agnico, even though they're obviously also the biggest components of the ETFs too. So you're essentially buying those same names. So, you know, Barrick will benefit from that. You know, Barrick's still an interesting name. I'm not necessarily trying to pull out Barrick as its own situation, but I think this is the quarter that these stocks finally get rewarded. And I guess that's the message, that if you're a CEO in this kind of environment, you know, you better deliver at this point. Because if it's not now, I don't know when it'll ever be.
Yeah, great point, Peter. If they can't make money at these prices, then there's bigger problems going on under the surface. Well, let's also shift over to the energy sector. A lot of interest in what's going on with the need for energy and more electricity to feed AI and to feed EVs and to feed the green initiatives, but not so much action in a lot of the energy sector. But it's been volatile in oil and nat gas. How are you looking at energy?
So we've been bullish and long energy stocks for years now. And, you know, right now it's kind of an interesting dynamic where, you know, I've been very bullish at least on the oil side on the supply situation where, you know, inventories are somewhat low and that is sort of a support. But now we're dealing with worries about the demand side and China slowing and so on. And then you throw in, of course, all the geopolitics. But you know, there hasn't been any disruptions at all to the delivery of oil, and therefore there really hasn't been any much of a geopolitical premium in it. But I do think that oil prices are still going to hover around $70 to $90 in the next couple of years. And a lot of companies in this industry are going to do pretty well with that. I've been very bullish on natural gas, even though the price has languished, because I think the demand side is just so tremendous, but supply side is as well, and why natural gas is in the two-ish range in the U.S. But I do think that the natural gas stocks, particularly on the midstream business, which is obviously less exposed to the vagaries of drilling and the actual price and more focused on volume, that the demand for global natural gas is high. pipeline companies are very interesting in that kind of environment. Commodities outside of that, I know you asked about energy, but that's my feeling with energy. And I'll throw uranium into that energy basket because, you know, I've been bullish on long uranium for years now. And I think the story just gets ever more exciting, which on the other hand means that, you know, you got to start thinking about if everyone is so excited, when's the time to exit this trade? And that's the point I'm trying to figure out now that it's become more of the daily news, particularly when you have Microsoft and Google and Amazon all talking about tapping into the nuclear grid, whether it's now with Three Mile Island or over the coming years and by 2030 in the SMRs, that, you know, you wonder if, when everyone loves uranium, it may be time to sell, even though at $82 a pound, to me, still seems pretty cheap.
Yeah, uranium has done well. 2023, a good year. 2024 started off well. We went through a bit of a drop, but boy, oh boy, that rebound has been quick. Peter, any other commodities? Copper gets talked about a lot. Any of the other, let's call them energy metals or critical minerals that have your attention that you see an opportunity in?
I mean, copper is definitely interesting. I mean, we have some of that exposure via some of the gold stocks we own. You know, I still wonder the demand side from China. So that has the, I know all the electrification bull case for sure. It's definitely interesting. Copper prices are going to remain wealthy for sure. The area of commodities that is really more exciting to me right now is not necessarily big picture, but at least now is agriculture. With corn prices depressed, with soybean prices depressed, with fertilizer prices depressed. You know, I like to buy commodities when they're depressed. And so we like some of the fertilizer names like Mosaic and Nutrien that we had owned before the Russian invasion of Ukraine and sold when prices spiked upon that invasion. And now those stocks are basically right back down again. And I like to buy things when a company is on the downside of a cycle, still generating good cash flow and paying good dividends. I think that's usually some margin of safety built in that I can't tell you the timing when corn and soybean prices go back up again and fertilizer prices follow, but I think you're getting, you know, definitely compensated for the risk that you take buying it around these levels.
Well, Peter, one other segment of the market that we haven't talked about in a while is the cryptoverse. It's kind of a different market outside of U.S. equities and outside of the commodity space. How are you looking at things like Bitcoin, Ethereum, or any of the other altcoins?
Well, it's interesting. You know, Bitcoin is trading very well right now. And I'm not sure why, maybe other than just maybe an election bet on who's going to be more supportive for Bitcoin. I still think that while I sympathize with the bull case on Bitcoin because, hey, I'm long gold, you know, I still think that Bitcoin needs to prove itself in terms of separating itself from being highly correlated to the NASDAQ 100. I think it needs to sort of trade on its own factors and not just be the speculative NASDAQ-like instrument. And to me, it hasn't yet proven itself in that way. It may well. I'm not making a judgment whether it is or it's not from here, but I think up to this point, it pretty much has. And I'd like to see some separation so Bitcoin can trade more like gold rather than NVIDIA.
All right. Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Financial Group, also editor of the Book Report on Substack. Again, click that link in the show notes to visit Peter's Book Report and sign up for it. It is well worth your time. Peter, we're going to be seeing you at the New Orleans Investment Conference starting November 20th this year. Hopefully, a lot of our listeners will be able to join us. Please, everybody, send us a line if you are heading out there, and we're happy to set up a time to chat with you, walk around the conference, even grab a drink. We had a couple different opinions and a couple similarities here on the economy, the markets, and commodities. I hope you all enjoyed this weekend show, and please remember to go back through our website, kereport.com, and subscribe to our podcast. Just search The KE Report in your podcast player to be up to date on all our daily editorials and company updates, as well as our weekend show. Everybody, thank you for tuning in to this weekend show. And Peter, again, thank you very much for your time this weekend.
Great chatting with you guys. See you soon.
The Corlin Economics Report is produced for A.B. Corlin and Associates. Opinions expressed on this program are intended solely for the entertainment of our listeners, do not constitute investment advice, and are not necessarily those of this network, radio station, or our sponsors. Find out more about this program and today's guests by visiting www.kereport.com. For Al Corlin, this is Colleen Robbins. Join us again next week for the Corlin Economics Report.